Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests, the usual lineup tonight. First, in about 10 or 12 minutes, we'll be joined by Dennis Perrin, who is a writer who has a new book called Savage Mules, which is just about how awful the Democrats are. The Democrats and Endless War is a subtitle, a book just out from Verso. And in this season when many people are looking forward to a Democratic victory in November, although that seems like less of a certainty than it did a few weeks ago, a reminder of the history of this party and the blood-soaked history of this party and what from that history we might expect should there be a Democrat in the White House starting next January. And then a little after the half-hour mark, we'll be joined in the studio by John Gulick, who is a sociologist who's been teaching and studies East Asia, and will be here to talk about the new configurations of power in the world, China, Russia rising, and the U.S. huffing and puffing a lot, but not really able to do much about most recently what's going on in Georgia, but more broadly, the rise of Russia and China has really put a crimp in American imperial power, and we'll talk to John Gulick about that and related topics. And before all that, some words on the news. The trend in the financial markets for the last few weeks has been something of a reversal of the trends of the previous months, years even. Oil prices came down sharply from their highs, and the dollar gained strength against the euro. I've talked a lot in the last few weeks about the oil price. No need to repeat all that here, except to say that it looks like the early stages of a deflation of a bubble that had been inflated by speculators. Sure, the real-world balance of supply and demand in the oil market is tight, but nowhere near as tight as the price of $145 a barrel, the high of a few weeks ago, suggested. And then there's the dollar. Part of the recent decline in oil prices, and the long run-up that preceded it, was simply a reflection of movements in the dollar's value against other currencies, particularly the euro. As the dollar falls, the price of oil rises, and vice versa. So the strengthening of the dollar over the past month, following the long decline from the peak set in late 2000, helps explain some of the movements in oil that we've seen. Late 2000, as the dollar was topping out, you might recall, was just after the peak of the dot-com mania and the unraveling of the whole, just before the unraveling of the whole miraculous new economy moment of the Clinton years. Against that multi-year decline, the rally in the dollar over the last month doesn't look like much, but it does suggest that some of the more apocalyptic readings of the state of the U.S. economy were overdone. In other words, we know that things are pretty bad, but maybe it's a stretch to think they're going to get profoundly worse. I don't think they're about to get profoundly better either. But long-term trends in currency values tend to reflect the relative standings of countries in the world economy. The long rise of Japan, for example, was accompanied by a rising value of the yen in the 1970s and 1980s. The 1990s were mostly a time where the U.S. dollar was strong, reflecting the outperformance of the U.S. economy compared to those of Japan and Europe. And the long slide in the dollar is a reflection of the end of that outperformance. Were the Chinese currency free to float, with the markets rather than the government setting its value, it would almost certainly have risen more than the few percentage points that Beijing authorities have permitted. Sure, a strong currency is bad for a country's exports, since it raises the price of its goods on world markets. But in general, a country that has to devalue its way to competitiveness is suffering from some fundamental weaknesses. A weak currency can be a stimulus, but it's also a sign that something's wrong. Enough of that theoretical digression. The strength of the dollar and the corresponding weakness of the euro over the last month are the result of a spreading sense that Europe is not immune to recessionary forces. It's not clear whether the old world is following the U.S. into actual recession, but it does look like the European economy is slowing substantially. Same with Japan. And so the relative situation of the U.S. isn't as weak compared to those two regions as it seemed a couple of months ago. In other words, much of the rest of the world is joining us in torpor. Until Thursday, that is. Hence that the U.S. Treasury might have to come and bail out the mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae reminded people during the Thursday trading day that the giant stink bomb that is the U.S. housing bust has not yet released its last traces of stench. And tensions with Russia over Georgia sparked a $5 rally in the oil market. But it is helpful to look at the action over the last month and remember that the U.S. probably is not going down the tubes. That's not to say that the U.S. isn't in a pattern of long-term relative decline, but the emphasis is on long-term and relative. Britain's long economic and imperial decline played out over the course of 5 or 7 decades. We're probably only a decade or three into ours. And Britain today is hardly poor or weak. So if you're given to reading, say, Mike Whitney's stuff on the Counterpunch website, please water it down his hysteria a bit if you want to get any truth value out of it. And now some less newsy comments. Financial crises always spark interest in marginal critics of the system, including me. By the way, I've come to see calls from mainstream media outlets as a sign that a bottom is near in a financial panic. I haven't gotten any of those yet, so this one may have some more damage yet to do. Some of those marginal critics should be given wide berth, however. One that's attracted interest from some people on the left is Ellen Brown, who's got a book and a website called Web of Debt. The stuff is somewhere between misleading and dangerous. Brown is a fine example of a whole mode of thinking that sees the problems of capitalism, like the polarization of rich and poor, and the system's vulnerability to periodic crises, as primarily financial in origin. Here's what Brown writes on her Web of Debt site. Quote, "Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal but not the interest to service the loans. To find the interest, new loans must continuously be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money." That's the end of the quote from Brown. You've got to wonder how people can spend the time it takes to write a book and still get so much wrong. In the 19th century, our money system was almost entirely private. Individual banks issued notes of varying reliability with limited geographic acceptance. And the national and international monetary system was based on gold, an entirely private and stateless standard. The Federal Reserve is a public-private hybrid, but it's a lot more public than the system that preceded it. And it's also brought a measure of stability to a system that was badly lacking in the 19th century. Almost half of the last decades of the 19th century were times of recession or depression. Commodity prices declined steadily, putting great strain on farmers in particular, and leading to the growth of the populist movement in the heartland. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, about the monetary system of the late 19th century that offers us a model for today. And her critique of the Fed as an inflationary force is deeply odd. The standard populist critique of the Fed is that it's too adamant about keeping down inflation, that it's all too willing to create a recession and drive up the unemployment rate to bring down inflation. That hasn't really been true of the Fed since the Greenspan years, but it was true of how Paul Volcker ran the institution in the 1980s. To argue that the only way that interest can be paid is by issuing more new loans is also deeply odd. Presumably, businesses borrow from banks to invest and to expand. Higher incomes and profits from those expanded activities should more than cover the interest. If not, then you've got a problem, but that's how things mostly work when an economy is functioning more or less normally. Brown festoons her site with approving quotes from individuals and magazines. One of the magazines is Nexus, whose website, in its own words, promises, quote, "the latest information on a variety of topics including e-smog, the ringing cedars phenomenon, crop circles, hemp, the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, spirituality, white powder gold, ancient mysteries, and extraterrestrials." Another quote comes from the American Free Press. The American Free Press is a successor to Spotlight, which was formerly published by the now-defunct Liberty Lobby. The Liberty Lobby was founded by one Willis Cardo, a big supporter of George Wallace's presidential campaign in 1968, who is perhaps most famous for having said, "If Satan himself had tried to create a force for the destruction of the nations, he could have done no better than to invent the Jews." The American Free Press's website links to the Barnes Review, a magazine and a book club. The book club features books on sinister Jewish influence, the brilliance of Hitler's blitzkrieg strategy of war, the wisdom of Robert E. Lee, and a history of the right race, quote, "presented from a white man's perspective that would make a meaningful gift for anyone who is tired of seeing the white race ignored, trampled upon, denigrated, and defamed." What does all this have to do with Ellen Brown and her web of debt? I don't know how she feels about the Jews or the poor denigrated white race, and maybe she just has poor taste in her choice of blurbs. But I do see a chapter from her book that purports to explain what she calls the illegal alien invasion. It's quite amazing to see how crackpot monetary theories are almost always found in conjunction with extreme nationalism, racism, and xenophobia. Here's an example of what I mean from a social critic writing in the early 20th century. Quote, "Thus, the task of the state towards capital was comparatively simple and clear. It only had to be made certain that capital remain the handmaiden of the state and not fancy itself the mistress of the nation. The sharp separation of stock exchange capital from the national economy offered the policy of a possibility of opposing internationalization of the economy without at the same time menacing the foundations of an independent national self-maintenance by a struggle against all capital. The development of the national economy was much too clear in my eyes for me not to know that the hardest battle would have to be fought not against hostile nations, but against international capital." That was Adolf Hitler from Mein Kampf, with only the words Germany and German removed. Cheap trick, I know, but a revealing one. This sort of pseudo-radicalism treats financialization and internationalization as problems, and not capitalism itself. Why is this wrong? I'll start with the easy part. I've always thought that internationalism was a good thing, that people and ideas and art and everything else should be free to move around without being blocked by borders or suspicious provincial minds. The financialization part is harder, but I'll try to boil it down for a brief radio commentary. The whole point of production under capitalism is not the satisfaction of needs, but the accumulation of money. In other words, it's impossible to separate the economic world into a good productive side and a bad financial side. The two are inseparable. The monetary surpluses generated in production, the profits of capitalist businesses, the salaries of senior managers, accumulate over time and demand some sort of outlet, bank deposits, bonds, stocks, whatever. No outlet, no money. No money, no production. And it's going to be that way until we replace capitalism with something radically different. So we have a consumer debt problem in the United States, not because of some sinister conspiracy of bankers, but because our managerial class has kept wages down for the last 35 years. So in order to maintain some semblance of a middle-class lifestyle, people have borrowed. The rich have had the money to lend to everyone else because they've claimed most of the gains of economic growth over the last three or four decades. In other words, you can't easily separate finance from the so-called real economy, and you can't really separate the economy from broader class relations. There's also a curious affinity between these financially oriented critiques and classical anti-Semitism that helps to explain why the two go together so nicely. Several writers have noted that a lot of the imagery of classic anti-Semitism, greed, deviousness, the hunger for money, separates out some of the bad features of capitalism and pins them all to the figure of the Jew, capital T, capital J. And nationalist anti-Semites have long hated what Stalin called the rootless cosmopolitanism of the Jew. So please, let's retire all this simple-minded stuff and use our brains instead. This is a very complicated system, not easy to figure out how it all works. But let's leave the paranoia and oversimplifications to the far right, where they belong. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Dennis Perrin. And that was some of Optimo by Liquid Liquid, part of a compilation called New York Noise, which collects some of the great music of New York rock, art, hip-hop, whatever you want to call it, underground from the late 70s, early 80s. And I remember seeing Liquid Liquid in a loft in Soho when they were known as Liquid Idiot, and back when artists and musicians could afford to live in Soho. But that's a measure of how old I am, I guess. And poor Liquid Liquid, most famous, I think, because Grandmaster Flash sampled some of their song. What was it called? Don't remember what the song was called, but sampled some of their music and made a big hit out of it while Liquid Liquid remained very obscure. All right, we're now joined on the line by Dennis Perrin, who is the author of the book Savage Mules, The Democrats in Endless War, just out from Verso. Welcome to Behind the News, Dennis.
Thank you, Doug, and I share your nostalgia for old downtown New York. I'm a New Yorker, too, from that period. I moved there in mid-1982. I lived on the Lower East Side, so yes, I remember that scene very well. When you could be poor and live in Manhattan and create your art. So yes.
Yeah, well, you know, I think our governor David Patterson says that it's the 1970s all over again, at least fiscally speaking. So maybe that lease will be good the creative
maybe
life here.
Yeah, maybe a new music scene. Let's see.
We'll see. So the Democrats, well, at least until some of the recent polls came out, it looked fairly certain that we're going to have a Democratic occupant of the Oval Office come January. That's looking a little less certain now, but I still think the odds are that will happen. But I think a lot of people are forgetting just how bloody the history of that party is, aren't they?
Well, perhaps not the listeners of your show, but I think, generally speaking, especially in the more mainstream liberal blogosphere and corporate liberal news and media organizations, that history, if it's known at all, is usually played down or excused or justified in some way. So I think it is acknowledged, but I don't think it really goes quite as deeply as I try to do in my little tome.
Actually, I do. Part of your book is a recollection of your visit to the Daily Kos conference last year, not this year. Now this year,
right,
they've renamed
right.
themselves; they've rebranded themselves as something even more grandiose. But tell us a little what it was like to hobnob with the liberal blogosphere.
Well, yeah, now they're Netroots Nation. Good name for a band, but. Yeah, it was the Early Kos. It was in Chicago last August, around this time last year, and I was brought into it by Professor Juan Cole at the University of Michigan. I live in the same town as Juan, and I'm friends with him, and sometimes tip a few ales with him while arguing about politics. And Juan's a very genial, smart guy, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners read his blog. And Juan was putting together, I think there were only two foreign policy-oriented panels at Early Kos, and he was organizing one of them. And he asked me to come on with him and a few other people that were on the panel, and Manan Ahmed from University of Chicago, who's a Pakistani intellectual, Pakistani-American, who writes a lot about Pakistan, obviously, and John Mersheimer, who co-wrote the book The Israeli Lobby. So it was quite an interesting panel in Juan and me. So, but I was really out of place because I'm not a member of the liberal blogosphere. I know people in it. I have battled with them online. I have argued with them online. I've received hostile emails from them. So it was kind of a shock for me to end up there. But, you know, you go where the action is, and so I went, and as I describe in the book, it's the last chapter of the book, what it was like, walking around and meeting some of these people who I had never seen in person but had read their bylines and whatnot. And basically, it was a very middle to upper middle class gathering of white collar professionals. Everybody had their laptops. Everybody had their power books. It was very quiet, very very corporate, very professional. It was not nothing like the Socialist Scholars Conference of the 1980s, I'll put it to you that way, where people would actually get into fist fights. I mean, there was nothing like that here. And I went to several of the panels, and, you know, I mean, they had people like Glenn Greenwald and Ari Melber of The Nation. In fact, The Nation magazine was very well represented there. I was quite surprised somewhat to see that. I suppose I shouldn't have been, but it was really just underwhelming, basically. And all it was, it seemed to me, was trying to organize around either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, and to a certain degree John Edwards, or organize around them and get them the nomination and get them the presidency. It was a very partisan, mainstream Democratic gathering, and the panels and discussions really reflected that. When I was on my panel, especially in the Q&A section with the audience, and it was a very, very nice audience, a standing room only audience. A lot of the people there were very upset to hear some of the critiques made, not just by me, but also by Mnon Ahmed, who was lacerating about Obama's comments about bombing Pakistan, which he took apart methodically, and the people wearing the Obama buttons in that room just looked crestfallen when this was happening, and they had really no counter to it, because I don't think many of them really knew what was going on in Pakistan. So, and the same happened with me when I was criticizing the Democrats as a corporate war party. I mean, they just looked, you know, confused. And it wasn't, and I didn't do it, and I don't think Mnon or any of us tried to do it to shame people or embarrass them. It was basically offering a different perspective and saying, look, you know, these people are not who you seem to think they are, and we're offering a different perspective. But unfortunately, it was a very minority position to take at Yearly Co's, and I don't think it made much of a dent.
And this is the voice of Dennis Perrin, who's the author of the book Savage Mules, The Democrats in Endless War, just published by Verso. And let's do a little icon smashing. You've got a chapter, for example, on Jimmy Carter, who gets a lot of pretty good press now for being such a sensitive human rights guy. What was the truth of the human rights era of Jimmy Carter in the late 70s?
Well, Jimmy Carter was the president who smoothed over the a very rough period for American imperialism with the downfall of the Nixon-Ford administration, scandalous administration, and the ascendancy of Ronald Reagan. So he essentially oversaw what I, as I put in the book, a period of imperial repair. And he did so under the cover of human rights rhetoric. Remember, his administration was the Human Rights Administration. And he would base all of his foreign policy decisions based on measures of human rights, whether certain countries were meeting the exalted standards established by the United States, like in Southeast Asia, for example. And basically, that served as a cover. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, I mean, Carter pumped money into El Salvador to the security forces there that were killing dissidents and peasants and union organizers, and of course the Archbishop Romero, who pleaded personally to Carter to stop the arms flow, which of course he didn't. He also was a major backer of Suharto in Indonesia and was arming the slaughter in East Timor, which was still going on at a very ferocious pace during his administration. He backed the Chun Doo-hwan regime in South Korea. And he was in office at the time of the Gwangju massacre, which the South Korean military, under American military guidance, killed some 2,000 South Korean student dissidents. So those are just a handful of, and of course, let's not forget Afghanistan. That Zbigniew Brzezinski keeps bragging about how it was his idea to sucker the Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan, and thus hastening the demise of the evil empire. And of course, although there's been a lot of debate since 9/11 as to whether the United States actually supported bin Laden, I don't think there's any debate that the United States did support and help put together, with the help of Pakistani intelligence, some of the most backward, reactionary, and violent elements in the Muslim world to attack the Soviets and to attack the regime that the Soviet Union was trying to keep in power. So we have Carter to thank for that. And he also accelerated the arms race, and the second arms race, and he reinstituted the draft registration. So Jimmy Carter did a tremendous service, and as I point out in the book, he is indeed America's most underrated imperialist.
Yes. And of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski resurfacing as an advisor to Barack Obama.
Of course.
And gearing up for yet another adventure in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Should he win. The hits keep on coming.
Yeah. Well, if we go back a little further, I screwed up my chronology. I should have. It's a little easier to shoot this fish in the barrel. LBJ, rather, elected as a peace candidate in 64, but proved to be anything but in 65, didn't he?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, he escalated the Vietnam War and the attack on not just South Vietnam but North Vietnam, and just engulfed that entire country in a massive, mass murderous, almost genocidal attack, killing millions. We'll never know the exact numbers, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting because LBJ to this day, and with some reason, serious reason, is seen as a great progressive Democratic president domestically, especially his signing of the Civil Rights Bill in 1965, with Martin Luther King standing at his side. But that was a very deft move on his part politically to ensure the black vote for the Democrats for perhaps millennia at this point. He was a very ferocious war president. He would not listen to his advisors, some of whom were telling him that it wasn't working. And I think people know the story about LBJ. And of course, remember also, while all this was going on, he also invaded the Dominican Republic.
That was just a little side adventure.
Yeah.
And of course, he was created by and helped create Brown and Root, the predecessor of Kellogg Brown and Root, or KBR, which is now somehow associated with Dick Cheney. But they were the people.
Well, those were more bipartisan times, I think.
Yeah, Brown and Root built the infrastructure in Vietnam, and a lot of actions that were previously performed by the U.S. military were performed by Brown and Root. So, a kind of early instance of the privatization that people now attribute entirely to the Bush administration. So,
a lot
of precedents there.
A lot of precedents, a lot of overlapping timelines, absolutely, and personalities. I mean, we just pointed out a few, Brzezinski being one of them. These people keep popping up time and time again.
And speaking of people popping up time and time again, there's also the Clinton crowd.
And
of course, there's a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals looking back with nostalgia on the Clinton years. Clinton, Gore wouldn't have invaded Iraq, right?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I get that a lot, actually, and from liberal critics of mine that, especially when they find out that I supported Ralph Nader in 2000, that sends them completely over the edge. But it's sort of a liberal catechism, article of faith, that Al Gore would not have invaded Iraq had 9/11 occurred. Of course, there are those liberals who think 9/11 wouldn't have happened if Al Gore had been president. He would have arrested the perpetrators and spared Lower Manhattan its tragedy. But there's a lot of other things I suppose Al Gore could have done or would have done, but we don't really know. But the thing is, with Al Gore, as you remember, the administration that he was part of, the Clinton administration, two-term administration, was very hostile to Iraq. They kept the murderous sanctions in place. They bombed Iraq on a regular basis and supported the Iraq Democracy Act that was a neocon article of faith in 1998 that people like Evan Bayh are now getting criticized by liberals for supporting. But Clinton and Gore were not outside of the mainstream when it came to that sort of thing. And a lot of liberals point to Al Gore's speech in 2002, I believe it was, where he criticized Bush's buildup for the invasion of Iraq. But if you actually go back and read that speech, it's not an anti-war speech. It's a tactical criticism of the Bush administration. Because remember, at the time, there was a split in the elite U.S. elite opinion about whether or not to actually invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam's regime because of all the problems that had already been mapped out by military planners and whatnot. So Gore was just reflecting that split. He wasn't talking from some anti-war position. He says in that speech that at some point taking on Hussein will probably have to happen. So he acknowledges that there will be an invasion, or at least something will have to happen, some kind of change, regime change, will have to take place in Iraq. It's just that he sided with the more cautious foreign policy elites than the more radical Bushites, and so we'll never know anyway.
Well, as did Barack Obama. If you look at his opposition to the Iraq invasion, it was mostly a tactical thing: the wrong war at the wrong time, fought in the wrong way. But he didn't really have a general problem with imperial war.
Oh no, and I believe if I'm not mistaken, didn't he like take down that statement off his website when his campaign began to take off?
I mean, yeah, when Bush's popularity was very high in 2003, 2004, that was briefly disappeared and then reappeared as it became more convenient.
That is change I can believe in.
me too. So based on all this history, should Obama win in November, what do you expect an Obama administration would look like?
Well, I don't think it'll look terribly unlike what the Clinton administration looked like. I think because some of these same ghouls are still, you know, hanging around and looking for jobs. There may be some new faces, but ultimately it's going to serve the same interests, obviously. And with a Obama administration, if he does win this election, and, you know, who knows, but if he does, I can't imagine it's going to be a landslide of any sort. It's going to be a very close election. And if he does pull it out, he's going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure to be presidential, to show that he can attack other countries, that he can be tough, all that. On top of which, he's inheriting a huge mess from the Bush administration. So he's got to deal with that as well. I mean, there's sort of a joke going around that, this is more proof of American racism, you know, screw up the country enough and then hand it to an African-American and say, okay, you fix it, when it's going to be, you know, and which will further, you know, mock the idea of a president of color taking over, that you would need someone like a John McCain to get in there and roll up the sleeves and get it done.
Well, it's just a kind of a high-end form of janitorial work, then.
Exactly. We made the mess, you clean it up, and we'll see in 4 years. But I imagine that Obama's going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure to appear presidential very early on, and I think that he's promised that if elected, he's going to expand the war in Afghanistan and bomb, if not invade, parts of Pakistan if he deems it vital to American interests. So we'll just have to see what happens. If that does happen, then, you know, watch out. Now, also, as far as Iraq is concerned, I don't really see much change there. I mean, I know there's like this recent agreement where, you know, the Iraqi government is drafting something up or saying that the U.S. can leave at a certain point. But again, I can't imagine that the United States, after spending all this money and thousands of lives and untold destruction, is just going to walk away from Iraq, I mean, without some kind of military presence. And certainly I can't imagine that a President Obama is going to oversee such a thing. He's saying it now, or has been saying it lately, because it plays to his base, but I think he's going to be saying it less and less the closer the election comes, especially if he gets really taken apart by McCain on the hawk issue, which is already starting to happen.
And finally, given the bloody history you've reviewed in part here, but review extensively in the book Savage Mules, which a book is not without a single footnote, filled with facts and a rollickingly entertaining polemic, I should say. Why do the Democrats constantly have to prove their imperial good faith? Why are they constantly hammered with this, you know, appeaser label, when in fact they've been such skilled and ruthless imperialists? Why do we have this constant recurrence of this theme of 50 years despite 50, 60 years of absolute bloodletting?
Well, I think, I mean, there are a variety of ways to go after that. I won't take up all the time and what time you have left to go after all that, but I think ultimately, on one end, it shows how apolitical our society is, that something like that could even be taken seriously. And it's a popular tactic on the American right to attack anybody they don't like as pacifists, as wimps, as not up to bloodletting, that sort of thing. But ultimately, I really don't know why that is, because liberals don't seem to know the history of their own party. I tell them all the time they have to embrace their heritage, that they shouldn't be wimp-baited by the Republicans. They have plenty to stand on. I mean, their party is the only party in the history of the world to use nuclear weapons. You know, I mean, there's that. The Democrats created the CIA. You know, another achievement they can take credit for. Among all else, there's so many other things that the Democrats have done. Going back to Andrew Jackson, I mean, I begin my little history lesson with Andrew Jackson, who was the first Democratic president, an American Milosevic, and who's now on our $20 bill, and go from there. I mean, the Democrats are an imperial party, and they have been from the beginning. And, you know, the fact that they embrace certain aspects of civil rights in the late 60s and gay rights and feminist rights, women's rights, and are primarily pro-choice for the most part, that has softened their bloody history somewhat in the eyes of not only their faithful, but also the people who don't like them. In a way, what they did when they tried to approximate or co-opt various grassroots movements in the late 60s and early 70s, especially with the ascendancy of George McGovern's campaign in 1972, this gave the impression that some of the Democrats had lurched left, when in fact they were strengthening themselves by bringing in more people who would become partisan Democrats. And among those people who came in during that period of time, of course, were Bill and Hillary Clinton. So in a way, it was a smart move, but in another way, it was bad tactics because it opened them up for those kind of attacks. But as I say over and over again to my liberal friends and critics, go back, read the history, not hard to find, embrace your heritage, put it right back in their face, man. The Republicans cannot match the Democrats when it comes to war.
And as Bob Dole once said, all the wars of the 20th century are Democrat wars, and he was right.
He was right.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Dennis Perrin.
And
the listeners can read that history in a convenient...
And don't be put off by my bad pronunciation. I've been doing interviews all day, and I'm, like, tongued out. But all my names are spelled correctly in the book.
So okay.
Don't worry about that.
That book is Savage Mules, The Democrats, and Endless War, just published by Verso. And we've run a little past the half-hour mark, so I'll just do the ID here on the fly. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with John Gulick.
Check it out. I said I broke into a Dustinville, yeah. And then I shot across top of how. I went to chill, yeah, break it up, Cypress Hill. I shake it up with the writings on the wall.
So don't give a fuck,
get damn it up. I rock on you, don't stop the jam it up. I rock on you, don't stop the beat, boy. Rock on you, don't stop. Freak it on, break down, don't stop. From the depths of hell, rock well, Romel. Rock on to the beat, beat. Check and shake, get your
check,
rock
check it out.
Cause I'm a jam up, hip hop, I'm making the tip top. Shake on the break down the needle on the high.
Everybody's
with the rhythm of the break of the shot.
Rock team at the horse, drinking all we brew. Never wanna go to school when that's a fact. So all of a sudden you got left back. Now you're feeling real low and mighty hurt. And your fans are snapping on you like you're a jerk. Now things are hard and you're feeling depressed. And your mind can't function cause you can't pass the test. You're saying to yourself, what can I do? I can't go home, I might as well quit school. Jobs are hard to find, everybody knows. And you can't do crime cause you're on parole. No education is a big disgrace. And so you might as well work at the sanitation. Can you get my drift?
And that's more from that New York Noise compilation, late 70s, early 80s music from in and around New York City. The beat bop, that was from Rommel Zay versus K. Rob. And we're now joined in the studio by John Gulick, who is a sociologist and been teaching in Asia for the last several years. And you're about to head to South Korea, right, John?
Correct, you are.
And what university?
Hanyang University, the Ansan campus, a satellite city of Seoul.
I thought I'd let you pronounce that because I was afraid I couldn't remember it, and even if I could, I would butcher the pronunciation. So
not that mine is perfect, of course.
Well, anyway, so let's talk about China and Russia and the decline of American power. It's just been amazing for the last several days to watch this posturing about the Russian struggle with Georgia. I don't want to call it invasion or whatever you want to call it. I guess it is an invasion, but it's certainly not the good guys, bad guys configuration that you see in the American media. But it's just been amazing to hear Americans like posturing as if they still are the number one guy in the world, and it's they can just dictate terms to everyone. And it seems to me that the U.S. is looking pretty powerless. It really can't do much of anything about Russia, can it?
Well, in fact, I might take a slightly different tack related to my own research and observation on the sort of evolving Sino-Russian strategic partnership in the global system and the implications for U.S. power. If indeed one might conclude that the medium-range outcome of the situation in South Ossetia and Georgia is the weakening of the client state status of Georgia and increased Russian leverage over its Western European energy resource, especially natural gas clients, this in fact may, to some extent, attenuate or reduce the necessity for a Sino-Russian strategic partnership, because perhaps controversially and quite unusually, I'm sort of recently reaching the tentative conclusion that the Sino-Russian strategic partnership is largely about, especially in the oil and gas export field, largely about putting pressure on the U.S.'s NATO allies, especially in Western Europe, to, if not outrightly resist, at least register objections to the expansion of NATO, the cultivation of, you know, so-called market democracies, client states on Russia's perimeter, and so on.
I think it's some people might not fully appreciate the what the U.S. had been doing in Georgia in recent years. There's really an effort to build it up as a client state, arms support, Israel also pouring military assistance into Georgia. So this was supposed to be some sort of American ally in the strategic underbelly of Russia, right?
Right. Perhaps most symbolic, if not substantial, the naming of the major road artery between the airport and the center of the capital city, George Bush, W. Bush Avenue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Well, they may regret that at some point. But now, why a Sino-Russian partnership? Aren't they growing strong enough on their own and with different interests? What's their commonality of interest?
This might seem like a bit of a detour, but I think an excellent way to address this question is to turn to a landmark book written in the mid-1990s by the esteemed historical sociologist Giovanni Arrighi, The Long 20th Century, in which he very cleverly claims that the coming successor to U.S. hegemony in the global system cannot be a singular nation state. The geopolitical system, the economic system on the world scale has become so complex and so interdependent that if any entity is to anchor hegemony in the future succeeding the U.S., it's going to have to be a grouping of states rather than a singular nation state. And I think a useful way of thinking about possible successors to U.S. hegemony is to think about this prescient observation made by Arrighi some 15 years ago, which, by the way, he has sort of disavowed in his more recent work. So in my own research work, I have entertained the idea, not necessarily embraced the idea, but entertained the idea that something like a Sino-Russian partnership, maybe full-blown alliance, could conceivably be the successor to U.S. primacy in the global system. Although I should add that from its very inception, beginning in the mid-1990s, the strategic partnership between Russia and China has mainly been about reconfiguring the international system in such a way as to allow for successful development in the two individual countries and promoting an ensemble of rules and norms and standards in international relations that cramp to some degree the arbitrary exercise of U.S. dominance, for example, demanding that international disputes be settled through the UN Security Council, respecting the territorial integrity of states, although, of course, that's taken a recent interesting twist in the South Ossetian situation. But there's been very little until recently economic substance in terms of sort of cross-border trade and investment relations and flows between Russia and China until, say...
Now, is that changing?
That's changing. Yes, it's changing. I believe, 2003 or 2004 was a watershed year because in this year, the long-sought figure of $20 billion of cross-border trade was surpassed for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there was, you know, much celebration in this about this in the Russian press, the Chinese press, and the various organs and interests that are, in favor of a deeper Sino-Russian partnership. But interestingly enough, as these trade and investment figures cross-border have escalated in the last 3 or 4 years to the tune of almost $50 billion in 2007, there has been increasing gnashing of teeth on the Russian side of the border because Russia is increasingly running a significant trade deficit with China. And the character...
What do the Russians bring to this relationship? Is it mostly energy, or do they have other stuff to bring to it?
Well, military hardware, of course, weapons systems. If I'm not mistaken, since the collapse of the former Soviet Union, China has sourced something like 90% value-wise of all its military hardware sort of bought off the shelf from Russia, largely geared toward repelling a U.S. defense of Taiwan in the event that Taiwan sort of gets very vociferous about its independence and China is compelled to invade Taiwan and the U.S., you know, rushes to the defense of Taiwan. The military hardware purchases have been sort of largely geared towards that particular sphere, air defense systems, diesel-powered submarines, fighter jets, so on and so forth. But another sticking point in the Sino-Russian partnership, which has generally increased over time, but a sticking point that remains to this very day is Chinese sort of military brass complaining that Russia refuses to sell China certain military technologies that Russia is willing to sell to India, for example, such as nuclear submarines, long-range bombers, and also that Russia refuses to license military production technology to China so that China can reverse engineer it or provide it for its own military defense needs.
Now, why is that? Does Russia see China as more as a rival than India?
I think it's a very complicated issue. Some of it has to do with sort of lingering historic antagonisms, and there's different factions inside the Russian state that remain concerned or worried that China's a rising power in the Far East and maybe has some implied designs on reclaiming territories it lost to Russia in the mid-19th century when it ceded vast territories in what is now the Russian Far East, courtesy of the Treaty of Beijing and the Treaty of Agun in 1858 and 1860. Of course, this is not official government policy, but you'll certainly find in many media organs, especially in the Russian Far East, occasional columns and articles which ventilate the opinion that through migration, through investment, the Chinese have a long-range sort of stealth takeover plan in the Russian Far East. And I would argue that this is one stumbling block to a sustaining and a deepening of the strategic partnership. Xenophobic attitudes especially remain quite pronounced in the Russian Far East, even though there is bilateral cooperation on a huge range of issues, coming from Moscow on one side and Beijing on the other.
But I would think that also the Chinese would have great lust for a lot of Russian natural resources, not just energy, but timber and other minerals and things like that.
Right.
Is that part of the relationship?
Yeah, the hydrocarbon energy resources are far from the only sort of natural resource sourcing going on. Timber is a huge issue, although a lot of the timber extraction and export is undertaken by sort of small fly-by-night Chinese investors who aren't paying customs duties and so on and so forth, and that also causes some consternation on the Russian side of the border. But also energy resource cooperation in different spheres besides oil and natural gas. So, for example, a deal was just inked recently. Russia is going to build two nuclear reactors on Chinese soil. It's going to provide uranium enrichment services. And there's plans in the works to ramp up or upgrade hydroelectric power capacity, damming vasty Siberian rivers and, you know, delivering hydropower-generated electricity to northeast China and so on. All kinds of other strategic metals and mineral deposits. But I'd say the oil and natural gas component is still by far and away the most significant geostrategically and economically.
And I assume that the Russians have an appetite for Chinese consumer goods. Is that part of the relationship?
That's part of the relationship. That's also part of the gnashing of teeth behind this increasingly wide trade deficit. A lot of the complaints you see in the Russian press sound suspiciously like a lot of the complaints you'll see in the Western European press or the American press about manufacturers on Chinese soil, be they state-owned enterprises or private firms, receiving export subsidies and discount credit and research and development rebates, and sort of flooding Russia with consumer goods below market cost. So I've noticed in the Russian press, not that I, you know, in the translated Russian press, an emerging discourse about Russia being swamped with low cost and Chinese consumer goods, and this being a threat to Russia's attempted economic resurgence. But of course, this also speaks to the fact that despite the fact that Russia has enjoyed, you know, vigorous economic growth courtesy of the high world market price for oil and natural gas exports, to some extent, the Dutch disease has set in and Russia has not successfully sort of rebuilt its manufacturing capacity, sort of thus laying the groundwork for some of these sort of protectionist style complaints.
Yeah, we've only got a minute left or so, but so are Russian and Chinese diplomats getting together and saying, how can we get together and counter this American threat? Is it that level of explicit rivalry?
I'm sure behind closed doors, the conversations take on that tone. Of course, in public pronouncements, diplomats from both sides always say our strategic partnership is not poised against a third party, but at the same time, the public pronouncements always say we're opposed to hegemonism and, you know, bracketed sort of offstage as U.S. hegemonism.
They're not talking about Belgian hegemonism, for
right,
sure.
precisely. We're in favor of multipolarity and so on and so forth. So it's a very fluid issue, and I think it's difficult to come down with a clear analysis of where things are headed, but I would argue that maybe in the last year or so, the U.S. ruling class, especially the realists in the foreign policy establishment, have caught on to the fact that the blunders and mistakes of the Bush administration have forged a stronger partnership between Russia and China. And in the here and now, sort of going forward, Russia needs to be isolated and China needs to be embraced, but in a way that prolongs U.S. primacy rather than undermining U.S. primacy. And we'll see how that plays out, especially in the event that Obama gets elected in the U.S., because as your previous guest noted, Zygmunt Brzezinski is playing an informal advisory role to Obama. And, you know, one of the key dimensions of his analysis in the grand chessboard and since has been isolate Russia and commercially engage China. So we'll see if that plays out more robustly in, you know, the years to come in the event that Obama gets elected.
And, of course, John McCain hates Russia, and his leading foreign policy advisor is a paid lobbyist for Georgia. So
Right. Whoever
takes office is not going to be very fond of Russia.
That is one guarantee in the whole equation, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with John Gulick, who is a sociologist who is about to take up a post in South Korea at a university whose name I cannot pronounce. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with this, lesson number one from Glenn Branca, also from the New York Noise compilation. Till next week. Bye.